This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is the 18th of June. Good morning, Inez. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Oh, beautiful little harmony
there. Oh, so excited to have you back, Priya.
Yeah, it's really great.
It's so nice to be back. How have you guys been? Congratulations on last week's show.
Oh my gosh, it was so sweet. How was it for you, Kate, to hear all our beautiful guests coming back?
It was really a lot of fun to meet everyone, and I think I walked away being like, it was full on, but it was a lot of fun.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's how we feel after every radiothon too.
First ever radiothon, congratulations.
Thank you. You all did amazing work, by the way.
Well,
and
thank you too. Just a reminder as well, it is our 50th anniversary month, and radiothon is also still going this week. So if you want to donate to the station, you can head to 3cr.org.au or call 0394198377 during station hours, which is 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. We are celebrating 50 years of 3CR and we are aiming to raise $300,000. So, you know, all of the shows have been doing amazing little recaps of programming that they've been doing, visiting archival audio, having previous guests on, members of the community talking about how much they love 3CR and why we should keep it going, community run and independent for another year. So please make sure that you donate if you can. Every little helps and every donation over $2 is tax deductible. So again, we're trying to raise $300,000 to keep the station on air for another year. But now we are going to bring you some more of that amazing 3CR programming that you tune in for. So first up, we are going to be joined by Kelly and Spike, who are two founding members of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, for a critical conversation about Vinny's CEO sleepout and for them to also share some reflections on self-determined radio programming by folks with lived and living experience of homelessness at 3CR, given their incredible history of programming at the station.
And then we'll be joined by Jeremy Poxon from the Anti-Poverty Centre, who's an unemployed anti-poverty activist and former spokesperson for the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. And they help us unpack how Centrelink has unlawfully cancelled over 100,000 payments. So we talk about the targeted compliance framework and the recent hearings, and actually how the hearings show that the department has underestimated how much of the cancellation has actually happened, because actually over 10 times more than they have said. And the next up, we will hear an archival audio as part of 3CR's 50th anniversary celebrations. And we dive into the archives that take you back 26 years to a pivotal protest against the World Economic Forum on the 11th to the 13th September 2000 at Crown Casino. And then we are joined again by Christine Carolyn from Save Community Health, who joins us me to unpack the recently released review of the CoHealth final report, what it was, and what was found. So it's really, really important, really vital moment in this campaign about the recommendations, the reactions to the report, and what's next.
Finally, we're joined by Chris Ferrick, who is a NAM-based painter and portraitist. Their work explores social change, collaboration, and developing accessible practices. On the 9th of June, Chris addressed the public hearing as part of the Senate inquiry into the NDIS Amendment Bill on behalf of disabled people against cuts. Today, they will talk us through what that experience was like, important issues raised at the hearing, the dangers of using AI within the NDIS, and why the inquiry report has been delayed.
Amazing. As always, it is a massive show. We love bringing it to you. So if you can donate, head to 3cr.org.au to keep us going for another year. But for now, stay tuned and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 18th of June. As Iran and the United States prepare to sign a so-called peace deal tomorrow, Israel continues aggressive strikes and drone attacks in southern Lebanon, killing at least 4 people and injuring many others in recent days. Iran's army said Israel has violated the Lebanon ceasefire dozens of times since the United States-Iran agreement was announced, and warned of a harsh response if attacks continue.
In other news, Palestinians across Gaza say that late-night Israeli evacuation orders followed by airstrikes are forcing them from their homes once again. Residents are reporting hurried evacuations, damage to homes and tents, and growing uncertainty over where Palestinians can find safety as Israel's expanded illegal occupation continues. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces and settlers continue to attack and raid Palestinians and their land, including burning mosques, violent physical assaults, wrecking of properties, and bulldozing of land.
Also in headlines, 4 First Nations men who were subjected to tear gas by a prison officer while detained as children at the Dondale Youth Detention Centre have won a High Court appeal, ending a 12-year legal battle against the Northern Territory government. The court found that the government failed in its duty of care to protect Josiah Binsaris, Kieran Webster, Ethan Ostrell and Leroy O'Shea and awarded them damages. Advocates said the ruling highlights the seriousness of the abuse and noted that 12 years later, the territory government has not apologised or taken accountability.
In other news this week, protesters rallied outside Labour MP's Katie Hall's Footscray office, calling on the Victorian government to save Foley House, a supported accommodation service for men with complex needs. The Salvation Army, which runs the facility, cites rising costs as the reason for closure, despite criticism that the wealthy organisation is withdrawing from essential housing support and leaving vulnerable residents at risk of returning to homelessness. Protesters, including workers and residents, said that people are already being moved into unsuitable accommodation or back into the homelessness system, undermining the service's original promise of long-term, stable housing.
And finally, in news headlines, scientists say a newly declared El Niño in the Pacific is likely to bring hotter and drier conditions to much of so-called Australia in the coming months. But climate change is making its impacts increasingly difficult to predict. Experts say climate change has already increased the risk of heat, fire weather, drought, marine heat waves, and coral bleaching, and that El Niño further amplifies these risks. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 18th of June, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
South liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
And you are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:10 in the morning, and we are now joined by Kelly and Spike, founding members of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, who are speaking with us as part of a critical conversation about Vinny's CEO Sleepout. And they're also going to share some reflections on self-determined radio programming by folks with lived and living experience of homelessness at 3CR. Now, tonight, the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, in collaboration with 44 Flats United and Flat Out, are hosting Winter Wildfire at Birrarung Mar, which is a downhill event to the CEO Sleepout. We'll talk about all of that and more, but for now, good morning, Kelly and Spike.
Good morning, Kelly.
Morning.
It's so nice to have you both on at the same time. I wanted to begin by asking you both about how and why you got involved in making radio in the first place. So, Kelly, I'll go to you first, and then Spike, if you want to chime in.
Yeah.
Well, I was so lucky. It's really an event that changed my life 12 years ago, I would say. I was a mature age university student, art student, really caring about the world at the time, still do. And somebody I was studying with was working on Ruminations, the peer homelessness radio show on 3CR back in the day, and he simply invited me along, and I've never looked back.
Yeah, amazing. And for folks that aren't familiar with that show, you can go to 3cr.org.au/ruminations to read a bit more about it. Now, Spike, what about you?
Well, I guess from the lived experience, I tagged along with Kelly, actually. I've always listened to 3CR, I guess. I've always been interested in people's stories and in telling stories, and I think, and especially social justice stories, and I think 3CR it gave me an opportunity. I was able to get some training. So yeah, I guess it was the closest, like the first stepping stone for me to get into activism, I guess.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you a follow up to that, which is really just like, you know, how you would describe the relationship between the radio that you've been making at 3CR over time and then your involvement in, like, the homeless community's struggle. And why is self-determined media representation so important?
I guess when you think about it, when you look at the alternative PR, like homelessness, like reporting, so to speak, or news coming from mainstream journalists or the legacy media, they're like, often it's like outsiders looking in, and because that happens, there's a lot of issues that come up in the way that they do stories. They're often looking for balance, and so they give a platform to some really gross perspectives, in my mind. Often their language choice can be really poor, referring to people like as drug addicts, as beggars, and people that are needy, like a charity, language based in the charity kind of view of people, often factually incorrect. They often support narratives of the state and perspectives of the state, and often trivial reporting of issues. And you have to wonder, what are they trying to achieve with some of the stories that they do, because they can contribute to the ongoing stigma of people having a living experience. So put that in stark contrast to the beauty of 3CR and shows like Ruminations. You've got lived and living experience voices and perspectives. It's trauma-informed, it's strengths-based language and analysis, and it's really clear where programmers like us are coming from. Like, we critique the state, we critique, you know, policies and practices and laws negatively impacting upon our community. It's really clear where we're come from, but that's often not the case with mainstream reporting of these issues.
Totally. Spike, do you want to add anything there?
There's nothing much more I can add. I think everything that Kelly said is right on the mark, and I think being able to identify systemic failure rather than turning a blind eye to it and having a charity response, which is what charity's all about. They recognise that there's a problem, but rather than addressing that problem, identifying and shining a light on it, they act as if they accept that it's just part of the status quo, and then we don't do anything about that. I think self-determined reporting is about hearing about how that impacts that person in their words.
Mm. Yeah, and I think something that Kelly mentioned before as well is like sharing the analysis and perspectives of folks with lived and living experience of homelessness, not just showing people as like a kind of, you know, just like an example of what the system does to folks, but showing that folks have an analysis and they know what's happening to them.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
And actually, Spike, I wanted to...
As an informed actor, I guess, it's liberating and it's sort of revolutionary in the sense that it's portraying them as an informed actor rather than as a victim.
Mm-mm, absolutely. Now, I wanted to ask you another question, Spike, because you and Kelly have both touched on the issue with the charity mindset and the charity sector's approach to homelessness. And apparently this year marks the 20th anniversary since the first ever version of the CEO Sleepout, which I know gets a ton of press and some pretty slick branding. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about what the CEO Sleepout represents as one of the most widely publicized charity-based responses to homelessness in the community sector's calendar.
Is that for me or Kelly?
That's for you, Spike. But Kelly, please feel free to chime in.
Look, as I said just a second earlier, I think it's an acceptance of the status quo. It's an acceptance of systemic inequality and basically it's how that the group of, you know, CEOs and neoliberal and economic rationalist people that have been able to push this idea that we don't have a responsibility to each other, that, you know, housing isn't an issue we should all be concerned about, like the government, for example, shouldn't be providing housing, and that it should be... The ironic thing about it is that they're completely funded, like 90% of their funding comes from the state and federal government, so they've got it both ways. They've got the tax cuts, and they've got the funding to provide a service, so it's actually I think people don't really know the truth about charities. They're not raising money to get to address poverty. Their money's coming from taxpayer dollars.
Mm-mm. Yeah, it's like It sort of privatizes the response and then makes it reliant on like people's goodwill, which is a terrible orientation to have to folks that you're meant to recognize as part of your community and to be in solidarity with. It means that you see yourselves as unequal rather than members of a community. Kelly, did you want to add anything there?
Just that we'll be asking for this year. They claim to be raising money for some ill-defined accommodations for women and children fleeing family violence. And we members of the union believe that speaks to like temporary housing, which is time-based. And once your time is up, those folks will have to find somewhere else to live, and they could easily be ejected into homelessness again because of the dire lack of public housing across Victoria. So we're asking for those millions of dollars that are raised this evening and the community CEOs have been raising over the past few months to put that into permanent housing for women and children so that the people have got a forever home and they can rebuild their lives, not determined by counting down the clock on their time.
Yeah.
Can I just say that's the other thing that the people who are doling out, I guess, like distributing the cash, like through St. Vinny's, are able to impose their sort of values on the lives of the people who are accepting the support, and so these people are completely unelected. There's no accountability. There's a real lack of transparency about who these people are, what their goals are, and the impact they have on people's lives. Like, you may not, you know, like someone's access to housing may be based on their sobriety or something that's completely, has nothing to do with their right to access housing. Like, and so I think that's another problem with the charity response.
Yeah, no, that is a really, really important point that you've brought up there, where, you know, people who are accessing homelessness supports are in a desperate situation. They need essential resources. They need stability. But making this conditional on particular kinds of behaviors or, you know, whatever different services decide is like an appropriate type of engagement. And often, as you both mentioned, a time limited, period of support. That doesn't really, you know, that's not doing anything to bring about like the structural change that you guys are asking for.
They're not interested in that prayer.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to ask you, you know, about what to do to counter that, because I know that the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, alongside 44 Flats United and Flat Out, are going to be hosting an alternative gathering tonight at Barrerung Mar. And it seems to me that this event, Winter Wildfire, showcases a pretty different politics of solidarity with unhoused folks than what's being performed at the CEO Sleepout. So can you talk a bit about that?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah,
look, I guess it's an opportunity for us to talk about how this impacts people. Hopefully some people will we can start the conversation, but hopefully people that are impacted by the privatisation of support, community housing, which is also is privatisation by stealth, can start to talk about how that impacts people's lives in real life. And so we can start the conversation and point out the St. Vinny's manage 160 public housing properties on behalf of the state government. Those properties, that they could be going to people that are on the public housing register, but they're not. And so we can start having those conversations about, so what does this charity response mean? What does it look like? And how does that affect people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is so important as well to be able to open up those conversations with people from different groups that are also doing organizing around housing. It shows that these struggles are all connected, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Now, Kelly, can you tell us about what's on for this evening and how people can join?
Yeah, well, we're all going to be meeting at Federation Bells at Birrarung Mar at 7 p.m. It's going to be a short, sharp and sweet event, just 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's going to be filmed. It's going to be streaming live on Facebook. So we want as many people to engage as possible. It's going to be really well lit, and we're going to be overlooking the Skyline car park where the CEOs are going to be, which is quite interesting. We'll be able to see them down there. As you've been pointing out, Priya, we've got friends from 44 Flats United arriving. We've got residents from the Flemington Public Housing Towers coming who'll be speaking, and their estate is up for demolition next, which is pretty alarming. So we can talk about what they're going through at the moment, how the community housing and charity-based model is affecting women and gender non-conforming folks that have incarceration experience. We've got your colleague from RMIT, David Kelly, coming to speak about some of the structural landscape of the community housing sector. And we've got Marie from Footscray Community Response speaking about the Foley House accommodation incident in the West and the Salvation Army kind of approach in Footscray. So there'll be a number of guests, and then we'd also love people to come up to the mic. It's going to be conversation style, so no speeches. Mm-hmm. We want to have a real conversation with community. And there'll be cups of tea and lovely cakes and biscuits, and we'd love for people to be there.
Amazing.
Can I just say quickly, Priya?
Yeah, yeah.
So it'll be also 10 years since we gate-crashed St. Vinny's Sleep out in 2016. And one of the things that we learned is the CEOs that were actually sleeping out had no idea about where the money that they were supposedly raising was going, or the difference between social housing and public housing, community housing, and how that money was being distributed. So it was really, we learned on that night that the people that are there actually know very little about what they're doing.
Yeah, that is actually a very good thing to remind people of. And I will note as well, I was having a look at their leaderboard of donors, and I believe that the leading CEO is the CEO of Woodard's Real Estate and Property Group. So it is, yeah, it's quite interesting to see how the model of charity provides a way for people to show that they're doing something while also operating within the sort of machine of the housing system that produces homelessness.
Yeah,
it's really tone deaf. It's a tone deaf approach. It's got to stop, really. It's got to start calling it out.
Yeah.
Well, look, I really encourage people to come along tonight. I'll be there, so I look forward to seeing you both. Is there anything else that either of you wanted to add before we wrap up today?
I would really please encourage people that have had any contact with any of these faith-based organisations through case management and felt like they've been hardly done by or treated badly to please come in and share their story with us. Because there's you know, like over the years, we've heard so many horror stories of community housing and support being taken away from people because of, you know, for different reasons. So it'd be really good to hear those stories.
Yeah, awesome. Well, yeah, really encourage people to get along. We'll have information in our show notes, and I'll see you both tonight. Take care.
Thanks, Priya.
Thanks so much, Priya.
Bye. And that was Kelly and Spike, founding members of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, who joined us for a critical conversation about Vinny's CEO sleepout and shared some reflections on self-determined radio programming by folks with lived and living experience of homelessness at 3CR. Now, as you just heard tonight, the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria is going to be collaborating with 44 Flats United and Flat Out to host Winter Wildfire at Birrarung Mar, which is a downhill event to the CEO sleepout. And you can attend it in person at Birrarung Mar at the Federation Bells from 7 to 8pm tonight, or you can join the live stream on the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria's Facebook page. It is 7:28 in the morning, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
3CR Community Radio Melbourne is Australia's first community radio station owned and operated by a federation of community organisations.
Hello and welcome to the very first edition of Women on the Line, the national programme of women's news and current affairs.
We're at our new studios in Cromwell Street, Collingwood, and the news, brand spanking new transmitter, just north of the Collingwood Town Hall.
This is the whole importance of having 3CR and public radio, is the fact that for the first time, you were hearing a black person's view about his life.
It does represent a unique achievement in democratising the airwaves, not only in Australia, but in the world.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Make your donation during our annual Radiothon. To donate, call 03 9419 8377 or go online at 3cr.org.au.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And now we are joined by Jerry Poxon. Anti-Poverty Centre is an unemployed anti-poverty activist and former spokesperson for the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, helping us to unpack how Centrelink has unlawfully cancelled over 100,000 payments. Thanks so much for joining us here today, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations estimate hearings? Why are they taking place?
Since this scandal has kind of engulfed the department, they've been fronting up to Senate estimates and basically doing the best they can to not reveal that much information at all. But as the scandal has been growing, as more and more people have come forward sharing their experience of this unlawful mutual obligations welfare compliance system, we've had more senators with more questions and grilling for the department, whereby earlier this month, they finally, after almost 2 years, have made a confession that, yes, there's now almost or up to or maybe even slightly more than 100,000 unlawful payment cancellations in their system, which is just through one section of the Social Security Act they're talking about. So there'll be more set of estimates throughout the year where we expect they will come clean about even higher numbers of these unlawful cancellations.
Yeah, thank you so much for explaining that, because through the estimates, it is actually roughly 10 times the number that the department has publicly admitted to prior to the hearings. And some other important clarifying things about this background on just cancelling all these payments. One, the employment services system is the second largest government procurement after defence, which is wild. And they also are giving like vague and incoherent information provided to people that are affected. So it's not just, you know, a loss of financial system. It's like a complete trauma and so distressing. And we also see there are minimal consequences for the providers who continuously make bad decisions and no accountability. I was wondering if you can also speak to, yeah, what the targeted compliance framework is. It really guides a lot of this conversation. And what are the continued issues with it?
Yeah, so the targeted compliance framework is the, I guess, technocratic mouthful term for the sort of semi-automated system of compulsory activities and punishments that operationalize the mutual obligation system. So put in a bit more layman's terms. This thing got implemented in 2018, and listeners who have been in the system, familiar with the system, will know it in terms of this is the demerit point system, right? That gives you a demerit for failing to do a compulsory activity, or for missing a provider appointment, or in the context of what we know, punishments that have been the result of technical glitches or provider error.
No, you keep going.
So this is a system that's been operating since 2018, and what the department has admitted, and the Commonwealth Ombudsman has investigated it for and has admitted in estimates, is this targeted compliance framework, which also, apart from its the department's automated system of penalties, also outsources incredible powers under social security law to, as you were talking about, private outsourced job providers to force people in activities, giving them the power to do an awful lot of payment suspensions as well. This has been running unlawfully, basically, since 2018, we now know. So the Senate estimates earlier this month was about just one small section of the Social Security Act that the TCF has been running unlawfully, which is called 42AM of the Act, which basically, and that's the number that they're counting as 100,000 so far, which basically means under that Act, the system is meant to give people who miss a provider appointment, for example, 28 days to reconnect with the job provider before cancelling the payment. The system wasn't doing that. It was cancelling people's payments before that legally entitled time of 28 days. That's what that number of 100,000 refers to, those people who will need to be recompensated. But that's just one slither of the Social Security Act that's been run unlawfully here under the TCF. The TCF covers half a dozen other parts of the Social Security Act. The Commonwealth Ombudsman took a look at 42AF, which is a different part of the Act, and concluded that almost 1,000 people had been unlawfully cancelled on that part of the Act, which is part of the law where the system is meant to, or the government is meant to, consider people's individual circumstances, like homelessness, et cetera, before cutting off the payment. The system wasn't doing that either. So those people are having to be recompensated. These are the cancellations that happen. And these are all cancellations have been, and payment deductions have been paused under the system because of all these unlawful issues, and because the government's going to have to start paying through the teeth to compensate these people. What hasn't been paused in the system, which I think you alluded to, and people in the system will know, is all the payment suspensions that are being doled out. Those are continuing at pace, and there was over 2 million of those just last year.
Wow! Yeah. 2 million, and you know we're zeroing in on this like small part of this act of the unlawful payment, but as you said, there's so many other sections that they do not consider, and it's such a important target for the government because it is such spending. But then you think about everybody that I know, or myself as well, like in the job provider system through Workforce Australia, not anyone has ever helped me get a job interview or supported me, or anybody else that I know. It's all been through ourselves, and it's just like this like continuous panopticon, like digital parole officer that you have to continuously report to. And, you know, we see now it's roughly 10 times what the number the department has publicly admitted to. I'm curious how the hell does that happen? And what incentive does the government have to really misrepresent the data in this way?
It's hard to wrap your head around it, isn't it? That a department would, A, have such terrible systems in place that are punishing people like this en masse to great devastating results, and now that we know, unlawfully. But the second part of it is that all through this scandal, the department has been cloaking itself in obfuscation. It's sort of done this very, we consider, strategic revealing of this information in slow drip feeds, and has required us to use FOIs and yank stuff out and to try and get media about it. It's quite unbelievable. Or it would be if we didn't have the Robodebt scandal and could immediately sort of compare it to, because it's the exact same departmental response, right? It's all self-protection is completely paramount. They want to deal with this scandal as quietly as possible, pay people off as quickly and quietly as possible, try to avoid any kind of legal action, class action, if they can, because the same thing that kept Robodebt going basically keeps the system of mutual obligations going, right? It is just it is similar in a sense of a automated, targeted, outsourced, basically political project to target, harass, and ultimately get welfare recipients off welfare is their ultimate project. And we've seen time and time again, departments and governments won't let something as pesky as the law or proper principles of accountability get in their way of that ultimate goal.
Yeah, exactly. And I really want to highlight, looking through a lot of the background from Anti-Poverty Centre as well, 46% of the people who had unlawful payment cancellations were First Nations, 24% people had their payment unlawfully cancelled, psychiatric problem, mental illness, injury, significant like literacy or language, alcohol or drug or alcohol dependency, previous relationship, homelessness, cognitive and neurological impairment and significant caring responsibilities. These are the people that this service should look after. And it is so disgusting to me that also the Ombudsman continues to provide false and misleading information about payment cancellations, despite the cancellations already like existing. They also state that there is no increase in complaints since there is a new complaint service. That seems very convenient to me. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you're right to point out how disgusting it is that the system does disproportionately target and harm First Nations people, people experiencing homelessness. You know, we've heard from women fleeing domestic violence situations being caught up with punishments because, you know, it's devastating. But of course, it immediately makes sense that the most vulnerable, disadvantaged people targeted in this hugely automated compliance system are obviously going to be those with the least ability to stay on hold for 10 hours to try and get payment suspension overturned or reconnect with the provider before cancellation. That reference to how long it takes to get the department on the hold and the complaints line does segue into why we believe a lot of the why the complaints numbers remain relatively low. Because while all this has been happening and the department's been licking its wounds and pausing parts of the system and trying to uncover how many people it needs to pay back for unlawful cancellations, et cetera, we've seen in the last year this massive blowout in wait times for both reporting these issues to the department's hotline and also trying to contact them through their online web form. So we've heard from people that it's like a 3 to 4 hour wait currently. So if your payment gets suspended or your provider is being an asshole, that's how long it's taking people to even make contact with the department to try and report it. A lot of these people we're hearing from are giving up.
Yeah.
We're hearing that people are having to wait 25 to 30 days just for an email response when they're giving this kind of information to the department. So people like those you mentioned who are in really disadvantaged, vulnerable states who've had their payment suspended, that is such a long time, a nasty long time for the department to give them to wait to try and overturn a decision that is probably likely affecting their payment and probably likely means their grocery budget, their ability to pay rent.
Yeah, survival.
Completely jeopardized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the complaints, yeah, sure, there's no increase if they don't exist because you can't even lodge them in the first place. Lastly, just to wrap up briefly, what if you know that your suspension has happened to you or you're impacted by this, how can you get support?
Yeah, so there's good groups available for people looking at this issue. Obviously, people can contact us at the Anti-Poverty Centre. You can look us up on our website. Please feel free to get in touch. We're on deck to support people through this system, connect them with services they need, and hopefully get them a good outcome. People can also contact the Unemployed Workers Union, who have a hotline as well and a website. So I encourage people to check those folks out as well.
Yeah, beautiful. We'll have that in our show notes. But thank you so much for your time today on such an important issue.
Thanks, Inez. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And that was Jeremy Poxon, Anti-Poverty Centre. He's an unemployed anti-poverty activist and former spokesperson for the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, who helped me unpack how Centrelink unlawfully continues to cancel payments over 10 times what they publicly admit to. And we spoke about the hearings, the targeted compliance framework and complaint services and how to get support.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 9419 8377
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:44 in the morning, and if you're just joining us, we heard first from Kelly and Spike of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria about the need to counter Vinny's CEO sleepout, the issues with a charity-based model to homelessness, and the importance of self-determined radio programming by folks with lived and living experience of homelessness. And then we were just joined by Jeremy Poxon of the Anti-Poverty Centre, who spoke with us about how Centrelink unlawfully cancels payments and all of the murky mess of the targeted compliance framework, as well as just a constant failure by government to actually center the folks who need support the most in a way that maintains their dignity and access to vital payments. And now we are going to do a bit of a throwback. So as part of 3CR's 50th anniversary celebrations this month, we are diving into the archives to take you back 26 years to a pivotal protest against the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September 2000 at the Crown Casino Complex in Melbourne. And this brought disparate organizing groups together into a broad coalition against globalization and multinational domination. And the protests were also known as the S11 protests, with a group of organizers across different groups called the S11 Alliance, and that's in reference to the 11th of September, which was the start date of the World Economic Forum. And effectively, you know, this broad coalition of groups basically staged actions consistently across the World Economic Forum meetings from the 11th to the 13th, where protesters were blockading entrances to the complex at Crown Towers to prevent people from getting in. They coordinated protests from a central stage. There were marshals. People were using walkie-talkies to communicate with each other about attempts to break through the blockade. And there was just, amazing, staunch organizing by folks to really draw attention to concerns about neoliberalism, about free trade and deregulation, and the impacts that this is having, not just in so-called Australia, but around the world. And, you know, with a very heavy labor union presence. And 3CR covered this massive public opposition and has compiled highlights of the broadcast on a 12-part CD called Globalization Unplugged, which was produced by folks, including our very own Juliette Fox. And we are going to play a segment of that CD, and this one focuses on police and government.
All of the police officers who are actually in the front line have taken off their badges. All of them have goggles on, and all of them have their batons at the ready. And right now we're going to cross live down to Bruce from Friends of the Earth. He's on Clarendon Street, that's the west side of the casino. Bruce, what's happening down there?
You might have just heard a bit of noise. We're down on Clarendon Street. There's a row of riot police, probably 100 in a line. Behind them are another line of police. We've just seen another bus enter in the main entrance to Crown Casino. The crowd is at least 500 strong here, a very strong presence, a very peaceful presence. They've been just chanting to the delegates who are going in, "The whole world is watching.
The whole world watching."
We've got the police spurring their horses into the protesters, and a couple of the protesters were caught behind the fence, between the police and the fence, and they've been caught, and the police are just pushing their horses directly into them. They're just spurring their horses on.
It's a crowd saying shame. We've got police in riot gear, mounted police, that have just charged the crowd. They've brought in buses by basically just
forcing the crowd back. They're using a disproportionate amount of force. If any of the listeners can come down, we'd really appreciate your support. There'd probably be about 500 police in right here and only several hundred protesters at this particular entrance. I'm actually on Queensbridge and Power Street.
Okay.
What the police are doing, the crowd's actually moved in on the police. I'm walking with the crowd at the moment and they're moving the police back into the middle of the road, which means that once again we've taken the road and they won't be able to bring delegates in on bus.
Fantastic.
So please come down. We really need your support.
First thing I saw was I was just coming down to one of the blockades and this man was just standing there and a policeman fell over and obviously the police, you know, thought they could take that out on him and they actually started punching him in the face and they punched him four or five times in the face with clenched fists and boxing style punches and he fell on the ground. I started kicking him on the ground and hit his head on a piece of concrete and I actually grabbed him by his hair and pulled him out from the police and I said to them, where are your badges? This is violence, this is not police protocol, you know what I mean? And those police were taken away by their commanding officers and just whisked away.
We just had an incident there where the police were pulling a woman back behind their lines and basically she was just being thrown from policeman to policeman and it was extremely distressing being pulled by her hair.
It's only once people speak and police can come through and there's a bit of violence associated here, but this is... been where lots of batons were used, and when we rocked up, there were people getting taken away in ambulances. So, yeah, definitely lots of protester injuries this morning.
Yes, we also heard reports that, in fact, riot police were called in and riding through the crowd, and there have been several ambulances that have taken protesters off to hospital. Do you think that is this going to have an impact on the nature of the Trades Hall Council and Labor rally today?
No, I think we're going to focus on the issues. I mean, it's regrettable that any violence, whether it's from the, particularly from the police side, but I think after yesterday, it was always predictable that it was going to go up a notch. Today, the police were incredibly restrained, and they were not going to be as restrained today. I mean, that was entirely predictable, and I would have thought S11 was prepared for that, but it does appear not to be the case.
I want to commend the police. I think they've done a fantastic and sterling job in showing restraint. And I want to urge protesters as well, if they want to protest, yes, do it peacefully and do it with respect, but don't interrupt the flow of people into this conference. I think that's inappropriate.
I think we have to put the responsibility of this sort of police presence here today, increased as it is, on those who are responsible, namely the federal and state Labor governments who have politically motivated the police to go in harder. It's very clear from all the comments made by Steve Brax and John Howard, of course, that they are motivating for the police to go in much harder than they did yesterday and to get rid of these protesters, to put it in terms probably familiar to them.
The combination of the various tactics being used, the changing of the shifts, the sprint charging of people, the failure to wear badges, the use of riot gear in situations where there is no riot taking place, leads one to suspect that very high up at the chain of command, and perhaps at the Premier, there was an order at some point to cease maintaining the peace, which is the job of a police force, and actually maintain the forum at any cost, even if that means breaking the peace.
It is just stunning to listen back to that audio and see how little has changed in the way that Victoria Police engages with protests. I think for folks who may not have been listening to 3CR back at the time of the S11 protests around the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September of 2000, which we were listening to just now, if you've been involved in Palestine solidarity organizing, if you've been involved with Disrupt Land Forces, if you've watched that kind of coverage, you know, I was on the ground for 3CR at Disrupt Land Forces as well. And it's exactly the same tactics that are being described by folks in this reporting. Exactly the same lack of accountability, violence against people that are simply there to cause a peaceful disruption, acknowledging the importance of a diversity of tactics, but for people who are there to say, we don't want this event to go ahead. And again, the same political discourse that comes out about saying, well, peaceful protest is okay as long as they don't disrupt the event that's happening, failing to acknowledge that the disruption is precisely the point. So that was part of our dive into the archives for our 50th anniversary celebrations, where we were playing a little segment of 3CR's coverage of the World Economic Forum protests, or the S11 protests, which brought disparate organizing groups together into a broad coalition fighting against globalization and multinational domination. And 3CR's coverage of this massive public opposition was compiled into a 12-part CD called Globalization Unplugged, and you can listen to the whole thing back on 3cr.org.au/globalization unplugged. And for now, we are going to go to an update from Inez.
Yeah, speaking of globalization and critically analyzing current events, IPCS is started a new collective called Football is for All. I attended the Australia-Turkey screening, and it was really, like, I have been a lifelong player and lover of football in kind of an obsessive way, and it's like so many sporting events that I've attended or talks, it's really hard to not talk about the politics of it. Obviously that's a lot of our brains and our listeners and how I see the sport as well, but it was really amazing to have IPCS and people there to talk about the current situations in countries, as well as what it means to really build a history of Global South and like third world organizing in people and players and working class football. And also we saw like Turkish protesters that were using bulldozers. So that's the kind of incredible information that you can gather by going to IPCS. So the next game that will be critically analysing the World Cup is Brazil versus Haiti on Saturday, June 20th, and kickoff is at 10:30. And yeah, there's also Tunisia and Japan on Sunday, June 21st. And it's a really important way to engage with the sport that we really love, but in a way that really means that we are not using our time for FIFA, capital F, all capitals, it's lowercase. It's Football is for All. Yeah, and I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, and I also wanted to shout out the amazing work and critical analysis of Palestinian Gazan journalist Abubakar Abed, who has been, you know, he is a sports journalist and he reports critically on football and has been posting on X and on Instagram with a critical Gazan take. He's currently based in Ireland, but a take on the World Cup, on sports washing, and just shares incredible daily analysis of this, interspersed with his ongoing coverage of what's happening in Gaza. So for just some really vital perspectives, encourage folks to listen to what he's been saying.
Yeah, and also on that, like even watching the Capo Verde Spain game, like Spain is meant to be like this powerhouse and is meant to be like a favorite to win, but we saw the Capo Verde goalkeeper block almost 7 attempts at the goal, which was truly like something out of just pure cinema. It was so beautiful to see. And what sucks is you can't really enjoy that moment knowing that afterwards his mother needed to be there and his visa was denied, you know, like, and it's happening in the empire of the US. So yeah, engage with the sports politically.
Oh my God, I just want to say one more thing because I'm so furious about this, but I've been thinking about this constantly. The Iranian team is not allowed to stay in the United States. They have to fly in and fly out for every single game.
Yeah. And what's really hard about that is when people are coming from different climates and different places, and usually you're allowed in the World Cup to come like a week or two early to like acclimatize. You don't even get that. Nothing.
Yes.
Nothing
at all. So please engage with critical coverage of the World Cup and with IPCS's Football is for All. And we will be back to you shortly with our next segment for today. Have you heard it on the news about this fascist growth thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah,
Yena Pasaran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe. Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist crew thing.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is just coming up to 8 o'clock in the morning.
And now we are joined by, again, a favourite of the show, Kristen Carolyn, the Save Community Health member, who joins me to unpack the recently released review of the CoHealth General Practice and Related Services Final Report, what it is and what it was found. You know, it was really long awaited, set to release in March, now released in June, and thank you so much for joining us here today, Carolyn. Christine, sorry.
Oh. Inez, it's been so good the way you and 3CR have followed this issue, and we really appreciate having an opportunity to talk to you again.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have done so much important public health reporting, but particularly around how far-reaching the impact of CoHealth is. Could you give our listeners a brief summary of what's been happening with CoHealth and sure. why this report is so vital?
Sure. Oh, sorry. No problem. So for listeners who haven't followed this, I'll just say very, very quickly that CoHealth announced the closure of three centres, Collingwood, Fitzroy and Kensington, in October last year. And they just announced it in the media, so I just saw it on television. People were deeply shocked because the Collingwood Centre, where I go, is an absolutely vibrant, energetic centre. And the idea of closing the GP clinic was deeply shocking. 500 people rallied at the Fitzroy Town Hall, and I think it was about 300 rallied around the Kensington closure. And put a lot of pressure on the state and federal governments to reverse that decision. And so the federal government gave CoHealth $1.5 million and said to them, "You can have this money to keep running while we set up a review," which they did. And the review was given a fairly short time frame to look at all the very deep questions about why CoHealth wanted to close three pretty well-used centres.
Yeah, thank you so much for briefly talking about that. And, you know, going through the review, there's quite a lot here. I'm sure that we'll continue to talk about this, but the things that really stand out to me is a lot about a lack of documentation and organisational structures, a lack of oversight for the board and the financial situation. And, particularly around, like, Medicare billing and wanting to put in more, like, a different payment system or, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the recommendations and what this really shows. And was anything surprising to you?
Yeah, I'd love to talk some more about that, Inez. And in fact, the review is actually 90-something pages, but what you've just summarised is pretty much it. The review said that there were four areas that determined the viability of the GP services, and two were external to the to CoHealth. One was the client base, and there are people with very serious health issues coming to CoHealth, and that's expensive for CoHealth. And the other was that the medical benefit scheme funding model is not covering those expensive clients, patients. But there were also two areas that the review reported were internal, and one was the CoHealth model of care, which the review found was not well organised and needed a lot of work and through management and wasn't getting it. And the review also found that governance was very seriously lacking in its response, and that the board of CoHealth, which is responsible, of course, for the governance of CoHealth, had not oversighted the huge funding deficit for 3 years. So that was really helpful to get that out in the public domain, but it only came out after a lot of argument about whether or not the review report would be released. So you're right, we only got it because an online journal, Health Services Daily, released it on the 2nd of June, and then the federal minister, Mark Butler, said, well, if it's been released that way, we're going to release the whole thing on the 3rd of June.
It's truly astonishing that that's how this came about. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on why CoHealth or the government would not want this report to see the light of day, or delay it as long as possible, maybe after the election.
Well, the Health Services Daily online journal is pretty answers your question. I think their headline on the 2nd of June was, "Damning report finds CoHealth failed on multiple fronts." And I think CoHealth did not want that in the public domain. I can't imagine, you know, that. And it is a very damning report about CoHealth's just lack of governance, but also how the management really failed to deal with these deficits. And and one of the things, I joined the campaign after that big Fitzroy Town Hall meeting because I was so shocked that that a wonderful service, you know, you've Inez had on your program from the Afghani Iranian community group.
Yes, that was a great interview.
She spoke so movingly about the need of refugees for not just access to a GP, but access to the wraparound services, so that somebody who's had traumatic experiences coming to Australia as a refugee, which probably most of them have, that they need an opportunity to have counselling that links into their GP service and pharmacy that also links in. But CoHealth actually sacked all the counsellors from their service, even though the state health minister said they were funded until June of this year. They sacked them 6 months early, just before Christmas. CoHealth closed the pharmacy at the Collingwood site, really heavily used by people with
substance use and dependence. Yes, absolutely.
And
I know, going through this report, we've spoken a lot about how important it is, but I really do want to zero in a little bit on how it does say CoHealth has not been effectively managed at all times. There's lack of staffing documentation, organizational structures, financial risks are not managed, operating at a deficit for multiple years. Did nothing to rectify the situation, and on top of that, did not challenge, you know, the management to provide any additional reports. There's limited evidence that they even attempted to make any change. It is so damning. I would encourage everybody to really, really read it. I'm wondering if you can just very briefly, because I know we're coming up to a little bit of the end of our time, and I know we have so much to go over, but if we think about what the review is recommending for CoHealth, for government, for clients, what is it recommending, and what have been the reactions?
Yeah, well, the report actually recommends that the State Minister for Health sack the CoHealth board and management and appoint an administrator. And that's deeply...
What's that?
It's a very big step. But the health minister for Victoria actually has the legal right to do that under an act of parliament. But
hang on, what does that mean? So they fired the board?
The minister can, but she hasn't yet, but she can sack the board and the senior management and appoint someone to step in as an administrator to get things back on track.
I see, yep.
And it's a huge step to take, but the review actually recommends that. It's on page like 90 of 99 pages, but it says that given the lack of movement, just like you said, Inez, that it's over multiple years because of the lack of movement by the board and by the management to take action on this work, that the minister should use that her right to sack them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a lot of the report also says, you know, for the interim support, there's a real significant cultural issue that needs to be addressed. And what we haven't really spoken about that we can another time definitely is about, yeah, the Medicare billing for GPs, right, and making sure there's alternatives to like a health program grant that can be a bit more flexible, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But very interestingly, they really are talking about the co-health site, which in Collingwood, which is very profitable, I will say diplomatically, and requesting a relocation or there's a lot of like up in the air about the location. What does it mean to have co-health in that space with that infrastructure and really address those inefficiencies?
Yeah, that's a very big and challenging question. We raised that back in November with senior management, in fact with the deputy CEO, and he said to a little delegation from the CoHealth Tai Chi group that CoHealth management were interested to sell the site at Collingwood because they thought it was run down. But we've cranked that back, Inez, and what we've asked the state government to do is to rebuild the site with social housing above a clinic, a healthcare clinic. And I'm very disappointed that that the Greens have just not picked this up, and because our local member for that Collingwood side and for the Fitzroy side is Gabrielle de Vietri, and she has really downplayed any responsibility by CoHealth and has said that it's all about Medicare funding, which is not what the review actually says.
Not at all. That is very interesting.
Yeah.
Christine, I know that we have so much to talk about, and I know we'll have more updates, and we have links on how to read the report. People want to just skip to the recommendation section, that provides so much information and is so vital. Yeah. This impacts so many people, like over 12,000 people, and then on top of that, the allied health staff and GPs. But thank you so much, Christine, for coming on the show and talking about Safe Community Health as well.
And Inez, can I just ask your listeners, one action out of this would be to ask, to write to Minister Harriet Ching, the Minister for Health, and say, please, and appoint an administrator and get these centres back running.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. We will put that in our show notes. Get them back running and let's save CoHealth and public health. Thanks so much, Christine. Yeah.
And I should say, Inez, they're running, but to get them back energetically running like they were in October last year.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Good on you. Thanks, Inez.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And that was Christine Carolyn from Safe Community Health, a local community-led campaign, talking about the recent review of CoHealth report.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase.
inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 9419 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Hello, you're listening to 3CR 855. It's a quarter past eight, and we are about to speak with Chris Ferrick, who is a Naam-based painter and portraitist. The work explores social change, collaboration, and developing accessible practices. Now, on the 9th of June, Chris addressed the public hearing as part of the Senate inquiry into the NDIS Amendment Bill on behalf of disabled people against cuts. Sorry, my voice is going. Today, they will talk us through what that experience was like and also some main issues that were raised at the inquiry. Chris, it's so lovely to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
I just wanted to start with, you addressed the Naam public hearing for the Senate inquiry that was held at the Stanford Plaza on Tuesday of last week. I was just wondering what the mood in the room was like and what some of the main issues raised by witnesses were on the day.
Yes, so I personally went in a support capacity with people who spoke for Disabled People Against Cuts, which is a loose grassroots network of disabled people. But going in person, the inquiry itself looks like a panel of people of various political persuasions listening to many different groups take turns on giving their evidence about the proposed NDIS bill. The people giving evidence are disability-led organisations, individuals, medical people, NDIS service providers, law agencies. You know, they all have very different stakes in the NDIS and bring a range of perspectives. And to me, it felt quite highly charged. You know, you could see people on that committee who were quite affected as they heard the evidence. They were shocked and angry, and, you know, half the room was crying at different times. In terms of issues, an amazingly clarifying thing, you know, even with that diversity of stakes, was that every single witness said that this bill in its current form should be withdrawn. So the harms have been detailed, including what has already happened, because the government needs to implement the findings from the Royal Commission and all of the other expert consultation it's received on this, just like FP Dan described on your show the other week. The NDIS is an essential public service. Everyone wants it to be sustainable. But that can only be achieved if they actually apply the advice that they've already invested in. So the consultation advice needs to be applied at the formative stage, as opposed to in retrospect, which is what they're currently attempting.
I imagine, yeah, it would have been an intense space, but very important for those emotions and, that space to be held, I think. And what were some of the main concerns disabled people against cuts raised at the public hearing?
Yeah, so they've removed references to human rights. This bill, it actually changes the characterisation of NDIS from being a rights-based approach to giving people individual supports. So, you know, support determination is one of those ways. It gives whoever the minister is sweeping new powers to cut support, cap support. It wouldn't actually matter who the government is. They could have that power. You know, and it means that they can continue to scapegoat NDIS when they have a funding issue instead of, you know, doing responsible spending. As well, you know, it's already a challenge to get onto the NDIS if you're having trouble accessing the information you need or the reports that you might need to give evidence, and it's going to make it even harder. So, you know, there's no replacement for a human sitting with a human to build a relationship over time, to talk, to take time to build trust, to build up a picture of what someone needs to live a life of dignity and to create a situation where they have choice and control. And for those two people to actually maybe have some choice over whether they sit together in the first place, because if we go back to block funding, which is what this bill proposes and is what existed before the NDIS, the bad old days, it's going to mean that you're assigned to whatever agency is your local one and you lose choice and control.
Mm-hmm.
Why this matters is because, let's say I still live in my rural hometown, I'm going to be assigned to an agency. That agency will probably be the nearest regional city, which is an hour drive away. If I have a provider who disapproves of me for whatever reason, so in this instance, because I'm gay and it's a religious organization providing the service, then that's going to influence their decision-making about what support I get. It's going to influence the way that I'm supported or not, and it might even put me in danger. And there's going to be no way to remove yourself from that situation if that's the only provider. So, you know, first off, the bill assumes that support does or should happen like machinery, as if it's only about a checkbox, and it's removing the spectrum of humanity on both ends.
Yeah, such an intersection of issues there that you bring up, and it's really very concerning to hear. And I think, yeah, one of the things that you touched on was that, you know, human to human contact, which is so important. And, you know, I just, you do wonder, we actually on the show this morning, we spoke about the cancellation of Centrelink payments because of use of, you know, similar, let's say, processes that were used in RoboDebt. And, yeah, just you touching on the human to human connection and conversations is, again, another issue that is being raised within now this new bill for the NDIS, which the government is proposing the use of automated decision-making and algorithm-based tools to assess the needs and funding of participants within the NDIS, claiming it will increase the efficiency of the scheme. And I was just wondering if you could shed some light for us on why this is so dangerous.
Yeah, so I'm really glad that you raised it, because what that means in reality is, yeah, replacing human decision-making with AI decision-making. And so a lot of people will remember the disaster that was RoboDebt. RoboDebt was when they attempted AI decision-making for Centrelink, and there was a massive investigation into it, and it was confirmed it was a terrible idea. It needlessly caused suffering and it resulted in loss of life. When the Commonwealth tries to cut corners with AI, or when it tries to apply blanket rules or relies on those checkboxes, it removes our humanity. The answer is in treating people as humans, treating workers like humans and not robots, treating people who access services as humans and not numbers for their spreadsheets. And to illustrate what I mean with AI, you know, anyone who's ever used an AI image generator is going to understand this instantly, I think. I remember, you know, trying out a generative AI tool a few years ago, and you could type in the prompts, and the prompt I ended up using was dogs wearing cowboy hats looking into the sunset. The image that came out was, you know, yes, it vaguely had a sunset in it, but the dogs, well, you know, one was definitely a mop wearing a cowboy hat. More than one looked like a pile of noodles. Yeah, a mop, absolutely mop. Just stringy pile. You know, a few piles of noodles. One was maybe a boot wearing a pancake. You know, the more detail I tried to add to this prompt, the less it actually looked like what I intended.
Yeah.
All right. So this bill proposes using AI to make decisions about what humans need to live. So what will happen is that they will automate their decisions using AI, and they will produce plans for people that will be the equivalent of mops wearing cowboy hats. And I'm using an absurd example to try and illustrate, but, you know, to unpack why that's really a problem, like any tool to automate is not going to give you the full picture of a person. It doesn't encapsulate my material conditions, my location, what cultural details are relevant for what will make different kinds of support or their delivery appropriate, what my social connection is like, what my material condition is like, whether my housing is stable or has been stable, whether I live alone, how I travel, if I can travel alone or not. There's so many factors that influence what support a person might need and what the condition their body is in. A medical diagnosis and other prompts of the robot cannot take into account, you know, how this human communicates and how all of these factors interact. And again, it's removing choice and control, which are the principles the NDIS is built on. You know, two people with the same medical diagnosis are not going to have the same needs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the condition of their body is not going to be static. So using automated decision-making, using AI for NDIS assessments is dangerous because it won't be able to take into account what things might radically improve a life or what might end it.
It's really concerning to think of what the consequences of getting that wrong may be. So in terms of the report from the inquiry, it was originally set to be released this Tuesday. It's now been delayed to tomorrow. So I'm just wondering if you could shed some light on, you know, what has caused the delay and timelines of the inquiry more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, the inquiry is way too short, the process to begin with. There was 4,500 submissions and they were expected to get through that in 2 weeks and be able to absorb all of that information, which is pretty outrageous. So to my mind, it's sort of a good thing that it's been postponed. And, you know, we need to take some action around that as well. I'm somewhat nervous personally and also curious to see if what was revealed at the inquiry, you know, how it's going to be presented in the report and if you know, the human reaction in the room, like how that might be reflected in that report as well.
As you sort of speak about anticipating that, it would be great to chat with you further in the future about, you know, when the report does come out and what Disabled People Against Cuts feels about that, which I would have been great to do that on the show today. However, unfortunately, timing has prevented that.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much for being on the show, Chris. Like, it's been very great speaking with you and it's just been wonderful. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Kate.
All right, and that was Chris Ferrick, who is a Naam-based painter and portraitist, whose work explores social change, collaboration, and developing accessible practices. They sort of spoke us through their experience of addressing the public hearing as part of the Senate inquiry into the NDIS Amendment Bill. And yeah, perhaps we can speak with them again with what has come out in the report tomorrow.
Yes, absolutely. And we will continue covering community opposition to this massive change to the NDIS scheme, which, you know, we've been covering over the past few months as the story has developed, and we definitely won't be letting go of this one. So thank you very much, Chris, for your time. And now, just in view of wrapping up, we'll take you through a bit of what we covered today. So first up, we were joined by Kelly and Spike from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria to talk about Vinnie's CEO Sleepout and the importance of self-determined radio programming by folks with lived and living experience of homelessness.
And then we were joined by Jeremy Poxon from the Anti-Poverty Centre discussing how Centrelink has unlawfully cancelled over 100,000 people's payments.
And then we played a bit of archival audio as part of 3CR's 50th anniversary celebrations from the S11 protest against the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September 2000.
And Christine Carolyn again on Save Community Health on the recent review of CoHealth about funding. And please read the report.
And finally, we spoke with Chris Ferrick about their experience addressing the public hearing as part of the Senate inquiry into the NDIS Amendment Bill 2026, and what the room was like and main issues raised, as well as dangers of AI within the NDIS.
Thanks so much for staying tuned to 3CR 855 AM. And just one final reminder for this week. It is week two of our Radiothon fundraising appeal. We are trying to raise $300,000 to keep the station on air and independent, community-led, bringing you radical radio for another year. So if you would like to donate, please head to 3cr.org.au. Or you can also give us a ring during business hours on 03-9419-8377. That's again 03-9419-8377 or 3cr.org.au/donate. And we will catch you on next week's program. But for now, stay tuned to Lost in Science. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.